New, if you like, a really original contribution, was the idea of the sail. But even so, it has for thousands of years been booked too high on the debit side of the brethren's account. To sell a man, to sell one's own brother? But after all, it is sentimental to judge without soberly taking into account the customs of the time and the country, which deprive the sail of almost all its unique and dubious character. A needy man sold his sons, and surely the brethren were in sore need. Fathers sold their daughters in marriage. The eight now sitting here would never have drawn breath, or been sitting there at all, if Jacob had not bought their mothers from Laban with 14 years' toil. It was a bit awkward, after all, that the merchandise was not at hand, but stored, so to speak, in a pit in the field. But it could be fetched at the right moment, and the first thing was to accost the strangers and try if they had desire to buy. Therefore the eight set their hands to their lips and cried out abroad, "Halloo, men and strangers! Whence come ye, and whither go? Stay a little, for here are shade trees and folk with whom to talk." The sound traveled across and found hearing from the merchants. They turned their eyes from the hill of Dothan and their heads toward those who called. The leader nodded, gestured, and turned aside to visit these natives, who had got up and greeted the travelers, putting their fingers under their eyes in token that they were glad to see the guests. The brethren touched brow and breast to indicate that here, as there, all was in readiness to receive them. The boys ran, flourishing their switches among the camels and making clucking sounds to induce them to kneel and lie down. The riders dismounted, went through the formalities of greeting, and sat down together. The brothers remained where they were, with the strangers opposite. The old man held the middle place, right and left of him the row of his companions, sons, nephew, and son-in-law. The retinue kept farther back, but between it and the heads of the party, behind the strangers, and in a space directly between the master and one of his sons, sat a figure with a cloak drawn over his head and before his face, so that only a gap of forehead showed. Why were the brothers impelled, during the preliminary exchange of courtesies, to keep looking at the shrouded figure in the second row? The question answers itself. The silence of the isolated figure involuntarily drew all eyes upon it. Everyone would have done as the brethren did, for who wraps himself up to the eyes in fine weather, as though a dust spirit were approaching? The brothers were not at their ease. They were distracted, not on account of that solitary figure. It best knew why it shunned the light, and might keep the knowledge to itself. No, it was because the merchandise they had to sell ought to be fetched, and it would have been well if some of them, two or three, had got up and gone to take it from where it was kept, and somewhat freshen it up before offering it for sale, as they had arranged in whispers to do while the company was approaching. Why did they not go? Probably because it had not been decided who should go. But they might have decided among themselves. Perhaps they feared to seem rude. But they could have made some excuse. Dan, Zebulun, Issachar, for instance. What held them glued to their places, staring distracted at the figure in the space behind the merchant and his son? Each side gave account of itself, with phrases in which boasting and self-depreciation were equally balanced. Jehuda stated that he and his were simple shepherd folk, scum of the earth, compared with the Lord sitting before them, and sons of an exceeding rich man in the south, a real king of the flocks and prince of God. Some of his countless possessions were pastured in this valley, a small part only, though more than the eye could take in. The rest were at Hebron, and there too the country was too small to hold them. With whom, then, had they in their unworthiness to do? The old man answered to all this that if one were to turn away his eyes from so much splendor and cast them upon himself and his troop, one would see scarcely anything, first because their eyes had been dazzled, but secondly because there was not much to see. They were indeed sons of the great kingdom of Ma'on in the continent of Arabia, and dwelt in the land of Mozar, or Midian. Thus they were Midianites, or, if you liked, Midianites, or, more simply still, Ishmaelites. It mattered not how they were called, since they were too worthless to merit a name. They had equipped caravans, which more than once had gone to the ends of the earth. They traded to and fro amongst kingdoms, convoying treasures worth a king's ransom, the gold of Ophir and the balsams of Punt. From the kings they asked royal prices, but amongst friends they were cheap. Their camels were laden with sheets of milk-white tragacanth, of exquisite fracture, such as had never been seen in this valley, and frankincense which would tempt the noses of the gods, so that no one, once smelling it, would smell any other. So much for the insignificance of the guests. The brothers kissed their fingertips and sketched a contact between the earth and their foreheads. "This land of Mosar, or Ma'in land," Jehuda inquired, "is it very far away, indeed, in dim and misty distance?"
"Very far in space, and thus also in time, certainly," the old man agreed.
17 days distant?" asked Jehuda.
7 times 17, responded the elder.
Even at that, its remoteness was only approximately indicated. In motion as in rest, for rest too belongs to travel, one must patiently leave it to time to overcome space. Some time or other, in the end, unexpectedly, time would bring that about.
"Then one might say," Judah ventured to think, "that these regions of their destination lay beyond our ken? God knew how far in immeasurable space?"
"One might so express oneself," assented the old man, "if one had never traversed the distance in question, and was not used to league himself with time against space, but rather to take no advantage of time for that end. If one was at home in that distance, one naturally thought about it in less fantastic terms."
"He and his," Judah said, "were shepherds, and not traveling merchants."
But if he might say so, the latter were not unique in their understanding of the patient pact with time against space. Shepherds, too, were travelers. They had to seek new pastures and wells, and to rove and wander, even as the lord of the road, in this respect being unlike the peasant of the fields, the settled sons of Baal. Their father, the king of the flocks, dwelt, as he had said, 5 days' journey southwards, and this distance, however insignificant compared with a stretch of 7 times 17 days, they had often traversed to and fro, so that they knew by heart every boundary stone, well, and tree that was in it, and nothing on the way surprised them. As for travel and the conquest of space, of course they could not compete with merchants from the dim and remote distance, yet, even as boys, they had come from the land of the rivers in the far east, where once their father had laid the foundation of his riches, and come into this land, and dwelt in the vale of Shechem, where indeed their father had built a well 14 ells deep and very broad, because the children of the city had been jealous over the existing water supply.
"May they be punished unto the 4th generation, said the old man.
It was lucky that the children of the land had not also seized on the well of the speaker's father, and zealously filled it up, so that it would have become dry, he added.
2 could play at that game, responded the 9. They had in the end been able to leave the Shechemites with a bitter taste in their mouths.
Were they then, the old man asked, such mighty heroes, so cruel and implacable in their wrath?
Shepherds they were, was the answer, accustomed to bear arms, to battle with bandits and beasts of prey, and not to give ground in disputes over pasture and well. But as for distance and stout-heartedness on the way, Judah went on, after the old man had paid homage to their virility, their ancestors seemed to have had wandering in the blood. He came from Ur, in the land of the Chaldees, and had migrated into these valleys, which he had measured across and across, unable to settle down. If one reckoned up all his wanderings, the sum would probably come to 7 times 17 days. But once he had sent his oldest servant on a journey with 10 camels toward Naharaim, that was Shinar, to woo a bride for his miraculous late-born and rescued son. And the servant had fared so briskly that it was scarce exaggeration to say that the earth had sprung to meet him. And at a well in the field he had found the bride and recognized her because that she gave him water with her own hand, and had also given his 10 camels to drink. All this traveling and conquest of space had been in their family, not to speak of its father and lord, who already as a doughty youth had left home and gone into Chaldea some 17 days and more. There he had come on a well. "Pardon," said the old man, as he stretched his hand out of his cloak and stopped the speech. "Pardon, my good friend and shepherd, if thy elder servant makes some comment on thy words. When I list to thee, and hear thee tell of thy tribe and its history, it seemeth to me that in it the well hath played a role as important as all your experience in moving and wandering." "How so?" asked Judah, and stiffened his back. All the brothers did the same. "Thus," replied the elder, "thou speakest, and every second the word well striketh on mine ear. You change well and pasture. You have the wells of the country by heart. Your father hath built a well very deep and broad. Your grandfather's oldest slave wooed at the well. Your father, too, as it seems. Mine ears are buzzing with all these wells." "My lord merchant," answered Judah, standing very stiff and erect, "meaneth to say that my words are monotonous and droning. That is grievous to hear. We brothers are herdsmen, not spinners of tales by the well, not lie-mongers of the marketplace, who have learned it and do it after their art, for hire. We speak and tell as we think, without artifice or skill. But indeed I would ask how one could tell of the life of man, for instance the life of shepherds, and not talk of travel and therewith of wells, without which there cannot be any coming and going."
"Very true," the old man interrupted. "My friend, the son of the king of the flocks, answereth me most aptly. What a part doth not the well play in the life of man? And how many tales and sayings are bound up with them, even in the mind of your ancient servant, whether they hold standing or living water, or are dry and choked with refuse? But indeed mine hearing, which is somewhat dull from age, had not been so receptive for the word, were it not for a strange matter we have encountered on our travels, which I reckon amongst the most astonishing within my memory. I trust that of your goodness you will give me advice and enlighten me concerning it." The brothers started bolt upright once more. Their backs were quite hollow. Their eyes stared unwinkingly. "Is there not, perchance," asked the old man, "in the country hereabouts where you pasture, a child missing, so that it cannot be found at its home, but hath been stolen or carried away, or indeed devoured by a lion or other beast of prey, because it hath not come home for 3 days?"
"No," answered the brethren, "not that they knew of."
"Then who is this?" said the old man.
He reached behind him and jerked Joseph's mantle from off his head. There he sat, behind and between the men, in a nest of falling folds, his eyes modestly cast down. His face looked rather as it had on the day in the field when he sat in his father's lap and related his shameless dream of the stars. At least it reminded the brethren of that. Several of them had leaped to their feet on recognizing the figure, but they all sat down again at once.
"Oh, thou meantest him," said Dan, seeing that it was time for him to display his snake and adder-like gifts, "when thou spakest of the well and of lost people. Nobody else? Well, thou hast made a great find. That is a slave, a nobody's son, a villain of the lowest sort, a dog whom we have had to punish for continual theft, for lying, blasphemy, brawling, impenitence, whoredom, and all heaped-up sins against virtue. For young as he is a standing sink of iniquity. Thou hast found him, and taken him out of the pit where we put him for his instruction, the gallows bird. Lo, thou hast been before us, for his punishment was out at this hour, and we were about to grant him his life, if perchance he might have profited from the chastisement." Thus Bilhah's son, in all his subtlety.
What he said had the boldness of desperation, for there sat Joseph, and could open his mouth if he would. But it seemed that his brothers might still have confidence in him, thanks to his thoughts while in the pit, for in fact Joseph said no word, but sat with mild eyes cast down, and behaved like a lamb that before the shearers is dumb. The old Midianite said, "Oh," and "Ah," wagging his head as his eyes roved to and fro between the culprit and his judges. The wagging gradually became a shaking, for something about the tale rang false, and the old man would gladly have asked his foundling the rights of the matter, but tact forbade. Therefore he said, "What do I hear? What do I hear? Such a rogue is he, on whom we had pity, and helped him out of the pit in his extremity? For this, I must say, you carried your discipline to the last notch. When we found him, he was already so weak that he could not swallow the milk we gave him. If you set any store by him, you have delayed full long with your rescue, though, of course, he may not be worth saving, being, as you say, uncommonly full of misdemeanors, as is shown, indeed, by the harshness of the punishment.